Yeah.
Okay.
Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hi, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it is a regularly scheduled weekly episode where we are going to pick a board game. We're going to talk about it, how it's played. We're going to talk about the strategies in the game. And then we're going to get into the design of the game like we do most every week. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Euphoria, Building a Better Dystopia. Euphoria for short. Designed by Jamie Stegmaier and Alan Stone, and published by, you guessed it, Stonemaier Games in 2013. Stonemaier Games.
Just to give a short description of what Euphoria is about, and when I say short, this is probably one of the longer descriptions that I've written out. In Euphoria, players are leaders in a dystopian society aiming to make their mark on the world and rise to power. This is done by sending workers to do your bidding in the four parts of the city controlled by the four main factions. Each turn, players place workers on the board represented by dice. The workers are represented by dice, not the board, to perform an action. Actions can include collecting resources from one part of the city, spending resources to dig up metal and artifacts, spending metal to build markets, or spending artifacts to gain influence over the elite of a given faction. Some actions will strengthen allegiances with a certain faction. In addition to your workers, two recruits give you aid from within the factions themselves. As you play, the number on the face of the worker's die represents its knowledge. Be careful your workers don't get too wise collectively. If they realize they're in a dystopia, they will abandon you. As you complete objectives, you gain influence. You place stars on the board and on your cards. After a player places their 10th and final star, they win the game. So that's the short description of Euphoria. Basically, you have these stars. You're trying to place them on the board by completing objectives, and you do that by using your workers to get resources, spend the resources to acquire other resources, and then spend those. That's right. About it.
Pretty much, yeah.
So let's get a bit more detailed into the parts of this game.
Yeah.
And let's talk more about the strategy.
Okay.
So first of all, this is a worker placement game.
Yeah.
And you have workers and they go to different parts of the board, but your workers are dice. And this is a central mechanic of this game that kind of influences your decisions that you make with your workers. When you retrieve or acquire a worker, or a worker gets bumped from the board, you roll it to determine that worker's knowledge. And then at a certain point in the game, which is when you are specifically retrieving your dice from the board because you've spent them all or because you just want to pull them back for some reason, and you roll the dice, then that is when you check your knowledge. So each player has an overall, like a collective knowledge stat that's tracked in the top of the board. And when you retrieve your workers and you roll them, you add the numbers that they show plus the numbers of the other available workers you have, in case you had one laying around when you did this. You add those together plus your collective knowledge, which is tracked on the board. And if that number equals or exceeds 16, then you lose your smartest worker.
Your highest number,
your worker with the highest knowledge, you lose them and you have to rebuy them. And you buy workers in this game by spending either 3 electric resources or 3 water resources.
We should go over the resources.
So there's 4 natural resources. Well, I guess you might call them natural resources, but I guess the other resources are metal, which are kind of natural.
There's 4 primary resources.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. 4 primary resources.
There's the aforementioned electricity and water. Then there is also food and clouds.
Mm-hmm. Right. I like to interpret the clouds as weather.
Yeah. Though I think they're literally clouds. Like,
yeah,
you're so mining clouds. Yeah.
Right.
And each of these corresponds to a different faction. And they're sort of each in a different part of the board. But they all work the same way in terms of how you get them on their space. Let's
go over those factions.
Right. There is the Euphorians, who correspond to electricity.
That's the yellow faction, if we refer to them by their color.
There is the Subterrans, who are the blue faction. They correspond to water. There's the Wastelanders, who are orange, and they correspond to fruit. And then the Icarites, which are green, and they correspond to clouds.
Gotcha.
Right, so each of these has a farm location where any number of workers can be placed on there by any player. And when you place a worker on the farm, different things will happen based on the total knowledge of the workers on that farm for every player.
Mm-hmm.
So if the knowledge is between 1 to 4, then you get one of those resources and the allegiance of that faction goes up by 1.
Mm-hmm.
If it is, I believe, from 5 to 8, then you gain one of that resource and you lose an intelligence. And then if it's 9 or higher, then you gain 2 of that resource, but you gain an intelligence.
Right.
And so this is the same for each of the 4 factions.
And gaining intelligence is bad, as you could tell, because if your intelligence is too high when you retrieve your workers, then you lose 1.
Right.
Specifically, you don't want your intelligence to exceed 3 for this game. And we'll explain a little bit why when we get more deeper into the strategy. But your intelligence can be anywhere from 1 to 6 on the tracker.
Yeah. And as far as the allegiance goes for the different factions, each of them pretty work the same way. There's a tracker of, I believe, 16 spaces. No, wait, no. 3, 6, 9, 10, 11 spaces.
Okay.
And whenever a faction's allegiance goes up, you move a tracker on that faction's tracker by one space, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on how far along the track it is, it unlocks bonuses for players that have a face-up recruit of that faction. And the first of those tiers is that you gain an extra of that resource when you go to that faction's like farm. And then the other ones are, there are tunnels, which will give you resources we'll get to in a bit. And you can get 2 rewards instead of 1. And then there is that you flip up a face down recruit of that faction. So this lets you get more recruits into play.
Right. So you start with 1 recruit from one of the 4 factions. And then you also start with another recruit face down who you have not yet convinced to be on your side and work with you
right.
in this dystopia. You flip those at 2 different parts of the game. You either can increase the faction allegiance on the tracker, like you just described.
Yeah.
Once it reaches that 3rd tier, that's when you get to flip it up and obtain all of its benefits, including the bonus at the farms and the bonus at the tunnels. And I think you were going to mention there are 3 tunnels on the board, but because they belong to 3 of the 4 factions, one of the factions, specifically the Icarite faction, which is the green one that controls the clouds, they don't have a tunnel because they're in midair. Yeah, so their bonus, their 2nd tier bonus in the allegiance tracker is just that if you place a star in their territory, you also get to draw a artifact card.
Right.
So let's talk about tunnels, mines, and artifact cards.
Right. So the 3 factions on the ground each have tunnels, like we just said. And
yes.
The tunnel is its own sort of tracker. It has a row of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 spaces. And when you go to the tunnel for a faction, you pay a resource, which is always that faction's resource. So mm-hmm. water for Subterrans, so and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get either a metal resource based on which tunnel it is. Subterrans give you steel and... the Wastelanders give you bronze, and the Euphorians give you gold, so they're color-coded.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can get an artifact card. These are these purple-backed cards that have, like, an object from our present day on them.
And yeah, so they'll have like baseball bats or books, balloons.
A copy of Viticulture by Stonemaier Games.
A pair of glasses.
A teddy bear.
Yeah, I think those are all of them. So these are like forbidden items from the past, and you use these in the game to gain influence with the elites. That's how it's flavored.
Right.
These are you collect these cards, and then you'll spend them at markets in the game to place your influence stars, which again is the objective of the game. You want to place your 10 influence stars so that you can win. That's how you win by placing the 10th one.
Above your intelligence is also a tracker for morale that also goes from, I want to say, one to six.
Yeah.
And your morale is your max hand size for these cards.
So you'll start the game with one morale, and certain actions will increase your morale. Most notably, you will increase your morale by two if you spend a food or a cloud when you are collecting your workers from the board. That will give you two morale. So that'll take you from one to three at the beginning of the game. You can also collect your workers by spending one morale. And if your morale is at one, it doesn't go to zero. It just stays at one.
Exactly.
Your morale is your max hand size. So at the start of the game, you can only hold one artifact, which doesn't really do anything. Most of the time, when you're spending artifacts to perform an action, you're either spending three artifacts of any kind, or you're spending a pair of artifacts that match, a matching pair.
Right.
The only time when you're going to spend a single artifact is when you are making, what is it? Is it called like the difficult choice or something like that?
Well, I was going to say there's a few ones that ask for a specific artifact.
Oh, a few markets.
Yeah.
Right. We'll get to markets.
Yeah.
I guess since we talked about mines, let's talk about markets. So,
I was going to finish up the tunnel because we didn't actually finish that.
Oh, right. Right.
So, okay. So when you go to the tunnel, along with getting one of those resources, you move a little miner down this track. And on the middle of the track, there's a space that lets you flip over your face-down recruit of that faction.
Mm-hmm, that's the other way to flip them over.
And then once it gets to the very end, it unlocks a, what's it called, an exclusive resource space where only people with a faction, or with a recruit of that faction, can use that space. And it gives you three of another faction's resource.
Yeah, essentially the tunnel is flavored to be like a secret passage tunnel from one faction to another.
Yeah.
And the way that it's flavored when you complete it is that you have now tunneled into another faction's territory and you can take their resources.
Yeah.
And since it took so much effort, now you can take like three of their resource.
Right. And three is kind of a magic number for resources.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So we mentioned that when you go to the tunnel, you have the option of obtaining a metal resource, whether it be gold, silver, or bronze, and you spend those to construct markets. So
there are two of these in the three main bottom factions. So six. Yeah, total.
The three ground factions, and each market has a construction cost that's equal to three of the metal resource that you get from the from the territory that it's in. So like there's two in each territory, and each one requires three metal resources from the faction in that territory, plus one metal resource from a faction in a different territory.
Right. So every combination is present.
Yeah. So for example, in the Euphorians, who give you gold, each of their markets will cost three gold plus either one bronze or one silver.
Yeah.
So the costs are static on the board, but the markets change for every game. There is a deck of market tiles, and at the beginning of the game, you'll shuffle them and deal six face down in these spots.
Right. And so when you put a worker on a space to pay one of the metal resources to construct a market, the worker should stay there. Mm-hmm. You can technically retrieve them still if you want to retrieve workers, but then somebody will have to spend that resource again.
Right. The worker has to stay on the board, and all four spaces that have these metal resources need to be filled up with workers in order for the market to be built.
Exactly.
So if somebody were to retrieve their worker from this space, then they are no longer helping to build the market. So once each of these spaces is filled and the resource costs have been paid, then the market flips over and anyone that helped to build that market gets to put one of their influence stars on it. And the market serves two purposes. The first one is that it provides an alternate way to pay resources in order to place a star in that faction's influence area.
Right.
Previously, the only way available was to spend 3 artifact cards or a matching pair of artifact cards. It just gives a second way to do that. But the other thing that the market does is it provides a penalty to anyone who did not help to build it.
Right.
And that would be anybody that doesn't have a star on the market.
Yeah. And these penalties can range from, like, not being able to spend pairs of items instead of 3 items, or mm-hmm. not being able to put a worker where there's already another worker, stuff like that.
Or it can go up to, like, not being able to use a market in a yeah. faction that you don't have a recruit in.
Yeah. However...
They can be some of them say, like, every time you roll a 5, you lose a resource.
Right. However, by going to those markets that let you spend 3 items or a pair of items, instead of putting your star in that faction's area for stars, you can put it on the market after the fact.
So right.
So you can still remove that penalty by doing that.
Right.
Right.
The penalties, I think in general, the penalties are about moderately annoying, but not incredibly detrimental in this game.
Yeah.
It's some of them, a small handful of them would be very detrimental if you didn't help to build them.
Right.
But the penalties won't completely disrupt your game plan.
Right. I want to jump.
For the most part.
I want to jump up to the Ikarites now,
mm-hmm.
because instead of markets, they have 2, like, general markets, I guess, or 3, really. So they have a place where you can spend, they have 2 places where you can spend a cloud and one of any other primary resource, so food, electricity, or water. And when you go there, you spend those, and it will increase their faction's influence by 1. And then also, it will either give you 2 metal resources from one of them, or, I believe, draw 2 artifacts from the other space.
Mm-hmm.
So they have, like, a trading system for how you get their resources. And then, also, instead of using a market tile to add influence, they have a space that lets you spend 3 of any metal resources to do that. Mm. For their influence.
Right.
Right. So then the other thing you can spend artifact cards on are, I can't remember what they're called, but they're like ethical dilemmas.
Yes.
There is 1 for each suit of artifact or each type of artifact card. And these start face down. On the back of them is your reference card, by the way, for like what resources are what. And when you flip it face up to activate it, you have to either pay the artifact card shown on the card or 2 of any artifact card. And all of them do the same thing, which is either you can place a star on them, which gets you easier to finishing the game, or mm-hmm. you draw 2 recruits, keep 1 face down, or unless, you know, keep 1 and put the other on the bottom of the deck or whatever. Keep 1, discard the other. I say face down, but if a square has been met that would flip face up those recruits, you would flip it face up immediately.
So if the influence tracker or the tunnel has reached the point where you would flip that recruit's faction over, then yeah, they interplay, flipped over,
yeah.
activated, ready to go. If it hasn't been met, then they are face down until that gets met.
Yeah.
Oh, and I don't know if we mentioned this, but you only get the benefits of a faction's allegiance tracker if you control a face-up recruit of that faction's
yeah,
type.
I think we mentioned that.
Okay. I think that's just about it for the mechanics.
There's one more
game.
Space on the board we need to cover, which is
okay.
the worker activation tank.
Right.
This is where you get new workers. There's 2 spaces. One of them is spend 3 electricity, get a new worker, and lose 2 intelligence.
which is good.
The other is spend 3 water, gain a new worker, and gain 2 morale.
Which is also good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then just to reiterate, every time you acquire a new worker, every time a worker gets bumped, and every time you retrieve your workers, you roll those dice to determine their new knowledge values. It's only when you are retrieving workers when you have to then also add up all your dice plus your general knowledge to see if your workers are too smart for their own good. Okay.
Okay.
So let's get into the strategy.
Yes.
The place where I'd like to start is with the recruits, because this is the first thing you're kind of dealt in the game.
Their first decision.
The board is set up. You pick a color, and then you are dealt 4 recruits. And from those recruits, you get to pick one that starts face up and one that starts face down. That will be flipped later on when you reach the allegiance or tunnel milestones.
Right.
So the best kind of recruit from my experiences is one that gives you free materials at no cost.
Yeah, this is
so
pretty
specifically
basic.
Free primary resources at no cost, or actually including secondary resources. Free resources at no cost is going to be the best kind of recruit to start with.
Yeah, there's a cycle that is like if you go to one of the, you know, the same recruits like farm or whatever, if you don't have any metal or artifact cards, you gain another resource.
Yeah.
And those are all fantastic.
Yeah, it's very easy to not have metal or artifact cards, especially on the first turn of the game. I mean, it's just like we say, when you're able to take multiple actions with a single action or take extra turns, that's always good. That's what happens when you go to a market with one or to a farm with one of these recruits, like from the first turn of the game, you're taking bonus actions.
Can we like come up with a term to shorten that concept, like the time walk rule?
Yeah, we'll call it the time walk rule. Time walk is a very powerful card in Magic the Gathering, which kind of proved this rule in gaming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sure. We'll call it time walking. When you time walk, I mean, we can call it shorthand, but
yeah. I mean, it's
probably should describe it every time. This is just podcast talk.
It takes a long time to say, you know, anything that gives you an extra turn is good. But
We'll give it shorthand time walk for the rest of the episode.
Okay.
So yeah, time walking is good, and these recruits that give you bonus resources from the very first turn are very good because they time walk from the very first turn.
Right.
I'd say this is appended, I guess. If that's a word, with the fact that you should want, actually, maybe this is like rule 2, you want your first worker to be from one of the factions on the ground with a tunnel.
Yeah, this is a pretty basic engine that we've pointed out.
Yes, and well, I'll explain it thusly. So the factions on the bottom have the tunnels. At the tunnels, you get to spend 1 resource of that faction's type to get a different kind of resource. And that space where you go to the tunnel is a space where you can bump dice. So if there's a dice there, then, and you place your dice there, then the dice that was already there gets returned to its owner. It gets re-rolled. And then that owner can then spend that dice on their turn because it's available now. You can do this to your own dice. So a very clean way of playing this game, a very good engine
efficient.
In this game is efficient engine in this game is to use your workers at the farms that you have recruits for, which will give you bonus resources because that's the first tier of bonuses that you unlock from the Allegiance Tracker. You get a whole bunch of resources from that faction of that faction's type, and then you go to the mine and you just constantly bump your own dice. So you can take a bunch of turns. You don't have to. We should mention it takes a whole turn to retrieve your workers.
Yeah.
If that's what you do on your turn, you can't do anything else. So this thing of just like cycling your workers through this tunnel, constantly bumping them is a good way of just never having to retrieve your workers. It's sort of like the inverse of a time walk where you're gaining an extra turn where you would have spent a whole turn to do nothing.
Yeah.
So the Icarites, the cloud people, don't have a tunnel, so you cannot use this strategy there. Well, you're constantly having to retrieve your workers.
What's even worse is the Icarites, their special spaces they have instead, they still require a different resource alongside clouds.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you have the one that gives you like a cloud and electricity or a cloud and a food, then it's probably not worth it.
Yeah. So in summation, you want a recruit that gives you a bonus resource at no cost, or you want a recruit from one of the ground factions to be your first recruit.
Right.
And then beyond that, your second recruit and the other recruit that you'll acquire later in the game, if you choose to do so, I suggest just either getting ones. If you have to spend something for the recruit, let it be morale or intelligence,
because
those are much easier to readjust.
Manage, yeah.
And manage. It's harder to spend artifact cards, and it's a bad thing to spend your workers in this game, because I think getting a new worker is like one of the most complicated processes in this game. Beyond spending artifact cards to do things, because they just require the most resources.
Though, with that being said, the Euphorians and the Subterrans, the electricity and water, those are the best, I think, for the tunnel strategy, because they both feed into getting more workers. So, like,
I thought that when we played last, I had a member of the Wasteland faction, which is the food farm, but my recruit also gave me water whenever I went to that farm.
I
guess technically it is called the farm, and the other places are called other things, but anyways, every time I went there to get the food resource, I also got a water resource, as long as I didn't have a metal resource. And I think if you are at the farm, the ones with the food, as long as you have a recruit that gives you the other resource that lets you build workers, you're still going to be fine.
Yeah.
But I guess, if you don't have one of those at your disposal, then probably pick a yellow or blue faction, just because they'll help you get to that that third and fourth worker. So let's talk about managing your workers' intelligence in this game.
Okay, so first of all, it's important to note that from when you start on 3 intelligence, and 2 workers plus 3 intelligence is guaranteed safety.
Yeah, because at most you'll be rolling a 15, and you need to roll a 16 or higher in order to lose workers.
Right, this is sort of an important milestone or thing to keep track of is, like, if you're at 3 intelligence, then rolling 2 workers is always safe. Getting above 3 is typically risky.
And also, then rolling... if you're at 1 intelligence and rolling 3 workers, that is also unsafe.
Yeah. But rolling 3 workers in general is unsafe, typically.
Yeah, at the least you'll get 8. Or at the highest you can roll with 3 dice is 18, which is very above the 16 limit. That's not accounting for your own... knowledge. Okay, so that means that you want to only be retrieving 2 workers at a time, and when you retrieve your workers, you can choose how many you retrieve. So what you want to do is put your workers in spaces where they're doing something useful by staying on the board, and then you're collecting the rest of your workers. So that means the strategy of this game is to you start with your 2 workers, and you can, safely manage your intelligence and place them in the farms and place them in the mine and shuffle them out and retrieve them. Then eventually you're going to buy another worker. And at that point, you should always retrieve 2 workers, but leave 1 on the mine, because even if it's on the mine, you still kind of have it available to you as long as you go back there and bump it again.
Right.
Just kind of shuffle that worker out.
Yeah. Keeping a worker on a space that even any player would want to go to and bump it off of is basically pulling it back for free.
Yeah. It's way better than pulling back 3 dice and then accidentally losing 1.
Yeah, because, losing a worker puts you back many turns.
It puts you back like
resources you need.
It takes 3 or 4 turns to get a new worker. So, losing one is huge, a huge setback.
Right.
And avoid it at all costs.
And if you had to decide like two out of four to take back, I would first recommend the ones on the like generator farms, whatever, that can't be bumped off at all.
Right. Start with those. And then take back like the ones that you have on the other spaces. I say pretty much just as a rule of thumb, leave the worker on the mine or on the tunnel.
And
when you get your fourth worker, that's when you start building markets and spending your metal resources. And what a perfect place to leave a fourth worker on the board or a second worker on the board when you retrieve your two. So you'll leave one on the markets, one in the mine, you retrieve two, or you'll leave two on the markets. One on the or two on the markets and retreat the other two. This kind of shuffling of dice and managing only taking two back and leaving the other one or two on the board in important spaces is a very core strategy of this game.
Now, when you roll four dice and you get over 16, you only lose one even if two of them are tied with the highest intelligence. So, like, worst case, if you really need to make a push for like very, very late game, if like every player has two stars left, then you can probably roll 4d6 and it'll be okay.
Right. I was going to say the exception to the rule of only taking two dice back is when you're in the end game and the victory is in sight and you know that you can finish the game in three turns. That's when you take back all four of your dice.
And
you keep three. Or I guess technically if somebody else is close, you could take back four a little before then, keep three, play them out, and then take those three back, or take three back and you'll possibly have three or two dice. Now, there's one rule that one small like bonus rule that we haven't mentioned yet, and that is that if you roll doubles, then you get to take two turns in a row.
If two dice of yours share a number, basically.
Or more dice. If more dice, if you have three dice that share a number, you can play them all on the same turn. So this is kind of the benefit or the reward for taking the risk of taking back multiple dice, because if you roll multiples of the same number, then you'll get to play them all at the same time. However, if you're just constantly bumping one die and you you have another die available to you, then there's a chance that bumping the die and then re-rolling it will match the other die that you control. That's also considered having doubles, so you can take a double turn there. So there really isn't as much of a benefit from taking back multiple dice and re-rolling them, more than two dice and re-rolling them, because you can still achieve and obtain that benefit
in
the normal strategy.
Another way to view it is technically you're going to have to pull back workers eventually. The difference is how soon you do it and what spaces are going to be available after you retrieve. I think part of why I like retrieving with only two is good is because it lets you, like, it makes it so that you don't have to take a bad space before you pull them back. You know, like, otherwise you might wait and be like, oh, I don't know if I want to go here or not. And, but I mean, like, yeah, but you're going to have to pull them back eventually. I guess frequency is also into account, but I digress. I want to talk about markets, though, and market strategy. So with markets, you mentioned that, like, putting a worker on a market's a good place to keep it so that it's doing something while also not in retrieval.
And again, the markets are the places where you spend metal to build them, and then later you can spend a worker there to place influence stars down.
So generally, you want to build on a market if you have the metal for it, because like it's a free point for one resource, basically.
Yeah, helping to build a market is the best rate of spending resources to placing influence stars on the board. In the game. Always participate.
So when you get that fourth worker and you put it on a market, that's sort of like asking a question to the other players, like, do you want to build this? I think putting your second worker on the market then is more of a threat, if that makes sense, because that's like, if you don't hurry now, I am going to finish this.
Right.
I would usually say make sure you have at least one of the alternate resource you need on that market, and then like mm-hmm. one or two of the main resource before you start building.
Yeah, I when we played, I had a faction that stated I would get a bonus water whenever I went to the food farm, as long as I didn't have a metal resource in my inventory. So I wasn't there. I think there's two ways to go about how you prepare for building markets, and that's either you carry basically enough metal resources to build a market on your own, or you carry just a little bit of metal resources to help to pitch in whenever the opportunity arises.
Yeah.
And I was in the latter category because I benefited more from having no metal resources. So I had very little time at the early part of the game to collect them. And then at the later part of the game, I would have one every now and then so that I could pitch in those kind of situations.
Yeah.
And you on the other hand had the benefit that came from having no cards in hand. So you could have as much metal as you wanted. You were in the category where you had enough to finish markets on your own,
which I did
when we played last, which you did. So sticking to either one of these is fine. Being able to build them on your own is, I guess, a little bit more, it's a little bit safer, because if you aren't in that category and you fail to have the right resource to pitch in, then you have to go by the card route.
Yeah.
Which means later on you'll have to spend three cards or two cards of a pair in order to place your star in that market to avoid the drawback. Now,
yeah, which means you'll also have to, you know, manage your morale.
Mm-hmm.
Now
it's not hard to avoid that situation, just because you can see what mm-hmm. everyone's resources are collecting, what resources everyone is collecting. So if you see one person has a lot of gold, then you just know, like, oh, I'll just pick up a gold soon, so that when they start building one of these gold markets, there'll be plenty of spaces for me to help pitch in.
Yeah.
You know, or you could just say, like, well, the three gold, one silver market has already been built, so I'll just carry around a copper for a little bit and pitch into that three gold, one copper market.
Right. I also want to say, so when you complete a market, everybody with workers on there rerolls those workers and keeps them in their available workers.
Mm-hmm.
So contributing multiple workers is kind of fine, because it's like a free retrieval, if that makes sense, because you don't count your intelligence unless you actually take the retrieve action. Mm-hmm. So even if you have four workers on a market, that means you roll all of them and don't have to lose any.
Right. So there's just as long as you can complete that market in a timely manner. Definitely don't commit three workers or more unless you have the fourth resource available to you.
Yeah.
Because it's going to take you three turns, because you have to place your worker out on the board to get the metal resource, and you have to take a turn to retrieve that one worker, and then take your third turn to place it on the market to finally finish it.
Yeah.
So, I'd say other than that, it's probably worth it to have the two workers on there
mm-hmm.
and just leave them on there for as long as you need to.
Yeah.
Right. Let's see. So juggle your workers, participate in the markets because it's the best rate. If you can't participate, then have the three cards ready to spend mm-hmm. as soon as that market is finished. And then in your downtime in this game, just amass resources and get artifact cards.
And advance the faction of your face down recruit.
Right. A lot of this game, I think, is balancing your time between this engine of collecting resources from the farms and spending them at the mines versus managing a faction's allegiance tracker, just because you want to get more value out of this engine. And you do that by reaching the second tier of the allegiance tracker. The first tier helps because that'll give you more resources from the farm, which lets you spend more at the mines. But once you reach the second tier, then you're getting the benefit that when you go to the tunnels, you get both the metal and the card from the tunnel. I guess actually this one's not super useful, just because you have that max hand size that you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so there is a point where it's too much value. But I guess that point doesn't come until very late in the game.
I was going to say, I think it's that the higher the influence tracker goes, the more useful it is late game. So, like, the tunnels are really good when you're starting to actually build and spend cards at markets. Because, like, getting cards for free actually helps you then. Or, like, getting cards at a quicker rate, you know, helps you pay for them in the three of a kinds or whatever. And then, you know, flipping over your recruit and then being able to put stars on it is literally pushing you to the win con.
Right. So, yeah. I wanted to say, like, personally, I like to this is going to be my last piece of strategy. Before I say this, when you take that ethical dilemma and you get to either place a star on the card or get a new recruit, I generally like to take a new recruit if it happens early in the game. But if it's like winding down to the end of the game, just take the star.
Yeah.
But I like to take the recruit, and I like to try to get that recruit to match one of my other recruits, because I like taking my final turn of the game to be increasing the allegiance tracker to the final space and then placing like three stars on the same turn.
Yeah.
Because you're placing like all your stars on your recruits. Because when you reach the final part of the tracker, you place your stars on your recruits of that type. And if you have two recruits, then you get to place two stars. So it's kind of like a final burst of, you know, push to the end of the game when you get to place two stars on the same turn.
Exactly. Okay.
Or more, because the markets that let you discard artifact cards will also increase the allegiance, as well as letting you place a star in a faction's territory. So yeah, there's a way to place three stars in a single turn at the end of the game, and that's what I like to do my last turn, just so that it doesn't look like I'm about to finish the game necessarily. With that in mind, if somebody's down to three stars, they might be able to just close the game out in a single turn. So you might want to like go for that extra push, take all your workers back, try and get doubles or triples. All right.
Okay. Yeah.
How is it designed?
Okay.
So it's a worker placement game with a fluctuating worker placement pool and the lack of exclusive first come first serve spaces.
Yeah. The whole bumping workers mechanic, I love it. And it's also in Charterstone, and in both games it's done really well. I think it's a very simple and intuitive mechanic that adds a lot of depth without a lot of complexity.
Yeah, it reduces complexity even. Yeah. Because in a first come first serve worker placement game, there's a lot of deciding, like thinking about, oh, what space are my opponents trying to go to? And what space do I need to go to versus what space do I want to go to versus, you know, where do I need to go first? What space is going to be most contested versus least contested, and what space is more pressing? But none of that really matters. All of that is taken out and replaced with this idea that bumping a worker gives your opponents an extra turn to use that worker.
Yeah.
Without having to retrieve them.
Right. The cause and effect is a lot simpler to understand. And so it's a lot more intuitive to know when it might be useful or when you might not want to do it.
It's also a lot less swingy, because you're guaranteed to use any space that you want to use. So your strategy is guaranteed to go off more or less. It becomes more about managing tempo.
Right. And there's some fun moments where, like, you can put a worker somewhere because you think that somebody's gonna take that spot later. So, like, it still does reward trying to, like, maneuver around your opponents and, like, guess what they're gonna do. But it's not in a, like, it's not in a purely, like, exclusatory one where, like, you know, you're taking something before they can. It's just that you put them in the position where they have to make a choice. So it's honestly more like more game is being presented,
but at lower complexity.
Yeah.
And then in addition to this, they add this dice worker mechanic where your workers are dice and their faces are their knowledges. And there's a whole batch of mechanics that surround that, with like the farms that add up your workers to see what effect you get, and your knowledge of your workers, and having doubles and triples.
You know, I actually kind of don't like this mechanic. I think this is a problem I have in games where, like, engine building and press your luck, like, RNG elements kind of clash.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, we talk about how you can prepare for the randomness and stuff, but in practice, it pretty much just means you can't pull back all your workers at once. Which, yeah. I mean, like, it's cool to point out that strategy, but it also feels bad that you can't do that, you know?
That, yeah, like, it's kind of like
all these four workers, but you still can only feasibly take back two.
Yeah, it seems like the good thing, the fun thing to do is to take back all your workers. Like, that's what you want to do when you sit down to play this game at first. You're just like, oh, yeah, I want to take back all my workers and take a bunch of turns after this. The good thing to do is to only take back two every time for the whole game. And so when the fun thing and the good thing aren't the same thing, then that creates this kind of schism.
Right, yeah. I like the idea of, you know, the intelligence being tracked in a dystopian society, and the intelligence per worker is just that the worker's a die. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a cool concept, especially for, like, component usage.
Yeah, I think it's all kind of elegant in that regard.
But I just wish it wasn't rolling dice, especially because one of the outcomes is, you know, taking an extra turn.
Right. It's although it's like taking an extra turn versus losing an entire worker.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like if there's a press your luck element, but the optimal play is to never interact with it, then, like, you know, what's the point of the press your luck element?
Mm-hmm. I will say that I felt a good amount of joy when I figured out the real way of utilizing this mechanic.
That's what I mean.
That was leaving workers on the board, only taking back two at a time, and then utilizing those tunnels so that I could just bump myself and never have to retrieve my workers.
Right.
That was fun when I figured it out, but that was putting a lot on me to find the interesting and fun thing to do in this game.
Also, that really only caters to, like, the Johnny and Spike sort of categories of, like, you know, either you want to learn the intricacies of the game or you want to outplay your opponents.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's not conducive to the other types of psychographics.
There's especially nothing for, like, the Timmy that wants to make big plays, because
it's the
big plays are
Timmy.
The worst thing. It's like when you're designing a game, you want to cater a little bit to each person. Mm-hmm. You don't want one of the person's strategies or one of the things the psychographic likes. You don't want one of those things to be bad in the game. You want everyone to be able to do their thing. Sure, some things are going to be better than others. Clear. I mean, obviously, what Spike wants to do is win, and that's probably going to be one of the better parts of the game. But that doesn't mean that the Timmy should be bad.
Right. Yeah.
In this game, the Timmy is kind of bad.
Yeah, and it's hard to, like, have a lot of cards in hand or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, it's kind of like having those big experiences are hard to do. I guess is flavorful.
One interesting thing that's kind of counter to traditional games is that this game rewards low rolls. Mm-hmm. And it's not often that a game cares about low rolls more than high rolls and makes you want to roll low. That's just kind of an interesting experience in this game, I guess.
Yeah.
There's a handful of role-playing games, specifically like Call of Cthulhu, where when you perform an action, you want to roll under a stat. You want to roll lower than a stat you have to perform an action successfully.
Yeah.
But yeah, most times it's like all about rolling high. I just think that's an interesting thing about this game.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So one thing I think is interesting is that the game plays very differently between different player counts. And I kind of have, like, a quick sort of set of notes that I realized about this.
Uh-huh.
So, like, the resource spaces rewards that require high numbers of intelligence, the 9+, they're mm-hmm. harder to get with 3 and 2 players. Because usually you'll have, you know, at most 2 dice, but 9 is still hard to do with 2 dice from 2 different people.
Right.
And whereas, like, with 4 and 5, it's a lot easier to get that high intelligence.
I mean, it's especially hard because early in the game, I think at most parts of the game, you're going to want to put your lowest dice on these spaces because that's how you increase the allegiance tracker of the faction.
It's like
on that lowest bracket, that 1 to 4
right.
bracket.
It's like
so if everyone's playing their smallest dice there, then they're adding up very slowly to get to that nine. Right. In a four-player game or a five-player game or a six-player game, in a six-player game, after, you know, three people or after four people place their ones and twos there, you're almost at eight or nine.
Yeah, like it just naturally gets crowded because people have to gain resources.
Right.
And so less intelligence gain happens at lower player counts, whereas at high player counts, more intelligence gain happens.
Right, because so, you gain intelligence when you're at that nine plus right. bracket that gives you two resources.
With high player counts, there's like a more more emphasized risk management element there. And since there's more intelligence gain, forcing people to gain intelligence from like an advisor, recruit, whatever, is also more useful with high player counts, which contributes to like a take that element, which I think is kind of neat.
I think there's only one recruit in the game. Maybe there's two in the game that will increase your opponent's intelligences when you go to the same space as them.
Yeah. But like there are, I mean, or just like going to a generator farm, whatever, to get resources and then make the opponent gain intelligence if they go there. Like putting your six on that space.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's more of that sort of element, which is cool for a higher player count.
Right. It kind of adds this like this new archetype to the game where it's like punishingly high intelligence for your opponents. Yeah. It keeps them out of the engine that is, you know, retrieve two workers at a time, because if you have four or more intelligence, then it's no longer safe to retrieve two workers.
Yeah, this is just like a common thing I realized with scaling player counts is like lower player counts, direct interaction that isn't shutting out is more common. But with higher player counts, people can usually kind of accept and roll with interaction that does shut you out from one thing because mm-hmm. there's so many people to change it.
So
also
this actually brought up a new strategy point for me, this part of the discussion. And that's that it makes water or electric better depending on how many players are in the game.
Yeah.
Because is it at water? If you spend three water to make your new worker, you lose two intelligence?
No.
Or is it
electric
the other way around?
Is lose intelligence because you shock them.
Okay.
Water
so
is
at a
gain
higher
morale because you make them not thirsty.
So in a higher player count, electricity is better than water.
Yeah.
Note that.
Markets build quicker with more players, obviously, which also adds a take that aspect for like, you know, players working together mm-hmm. to build a market so other people get the penalty.
Also, if you have more than four players, then there's a cheat. It's likely that one of the players won't be able to help build the market.
Yeah. Initiating
it's also possible that one of the players won't even have a chance to help build it. So yeah initiating the market becomes more powerful because then you're guaranteed.
When we played with six people, was it?
Yeah.
Like everybody would have a part where it's like, who wants to start building? Let's build. Let's go. And that was a pretty funny moment, by the way. Mm-hmm. But then on lower player counts, resources ramp up slower with like the advisors or the alliance tracker going up slower. And you don't get the two resource in an intelligence space as much. So like how advisors overlap is a bit more complex, and markets are a higher risk at low player count because of the way it works. They're higher risk for you to invest in
mm-hmm.
because, you know, you might need to invest more time into your own market, like we said. So it's just a different feel. I think it's good when a game that scales is able to do that kind of naturally. Because, I mean, this is just from my experience that different people want different things at different player counts. You know? Mm-hmm. Even mm-hmm. something like Seven Wonders is still kind of like a 1v2 when you're with seven players.
Right.
But, like, I always picture, like, Commander in Magic. It's like a very frantic thing with four or more players. With fewer players, it becomes a lot more strategic instead of, like, you know, high-powered spell-flinging, take that type of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the board.
Oh, no.
And what it looks like. Well, okay, so graphically, the board is a little busy. I think just because they try to use too many transparencies and borders and like visual clutter that makes it a little hard to make out the different spaces where it's you can really go and what they do.
Yeah.
It's a little cluttered. I will give them this though, and that is that the flow of gameplay goes from the outside in on the board. So the four places where you place your dice to obtain the primary resources, they're on the edges of the board.
That's not true.
That's not true.
Electricity is in the center.
Electricity is in the center? Never mind. My whole thing is shattered.
No, each three of the factions is on the right of where their markets are.
Oh, okay. They're on the right. Except, wait, isn't the water factions on the right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, at least the tunnels are in the center of the board.
Not quite. Electricity starts on the outside and goes in.
Electricity. Why you gotta be so bad? All right, never mind. The board's bad.
Yeah.
That's, I misremembered.
What I was gonna say is, it's like they kinda wanted to arrange things flavorfully.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the electricity tunnel goes from the open space with electricity down to subterranean. Mm-hmm. And additionally, like the electricity thing is in the center because on the art for the board, that's where the generators are, you know, and like the buildings are in the electricity area are where the markets go. But that makes it not just cluttered, but kind of hard to organize mentally. It's like, okay, I want to get the electric resource, so I go here, but wait, the tunnel is over here. If I want to get the water, is that like, you know, the water tunnel and the food tunnel go in opposite directions, which makes sense if you're like going tunneling from one faction to the other. But it still, for me at least, makes it hard to keep track of where I put the worker.
Like, right.
You put the worker on one end of the tunnel for water to gain the resource and on the other end for food to gain the resource.
Right. The tunnels being flipped is super annoying. And the tracker moves in different directions. So every time you go there, you have to think like what if they all just face the same way and the tracker just moved left to right? But instead, you know, one of them moves right to left. And so you got to think like, which way am I pushing this tracker? Okay. The board is bad. It's kind of disorganized. It's trying to place itself in ways that make sense into like a physical world. But like, this is a board. It's a flat thing that we're looking down on. And most of the illustrations that kind of explain why something is where it is are just being covered up by the elements on the board.
Yeah.
So there's no point in placing them like that.
The worker activation tank is in the bottom left corner, just kind of tucked away.
Yeah.
So you need to place a worker there to get a worker, which is huge, but it's hidden. And it's under something that isn't even a space, which is the thing that shows you how spending certain resources gives you morale when you retrieve your workers.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's not even a space you put your workers, and it's above where the plane that gives you more workers is. Also, the miner for the tunnel is super small, and it's hard to keep track of, honestly. Because, like, you go there, you pay the resource, you get resources, and, like, that's all cool. That's what you want to do. But then after that, you still have to remember to move this miner one space. Mm-hmm. And the number of spaces that is on that tracker kind of makes it easy to get mixed up and lost. Like, wait, did I move it or not? Was it already there or did it move there just now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, to give Stonemaier Games the benefit of the doubt, this was one of their first games that they published.
Yeah, I think it's technically their second, which is still one of their first.
It came after Viticulture, right? Because, yeah, I mean, Viticulture is an element in this game.
Yeah.
Now, I guess we got to get to Viticulture one of these days. Probably not next episode, because that would be too great a density of Stonemaier Games. But to give them the benefit of the doubt, these are the kind of things that you'd probably figure out after gaining some experience making a bunch of board games that, like, it probably makes sense to place elements on a board logically based on the way the game is played versus the way that the world was illustrated. Come on. They could have even just put the generator characters on the board's artwork. Just flip the whole yellow faction.
Yeah.
Just draw a line around that part of the board, that illustration, right click, transform, flip horizontally, and then put the stuff back on the board.
And maybe use like a blur tool to refer to the background.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, take out a brush, blender brush, make it look like it was like that all along. And then, yeah, just actually just erase the whole background and then place the things where they make sense mechanically and not in the illustration.
Yeah, I think like
board. Which again, you can't even see when all the pieces are on the board.
Yeah, I was going to say like board flow is a topic that I don't think many designers discuss on stuff like this. Or like in like, you know, when you're talking about how to design games, like mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, the design of a board shouldn't just fit the mechanical purpose, but should make information easy to follow and be organized mm-hmm. a certain way, you know, like a flow chart.
I mean, yeah, it's the biggest thing in the game. So it should be like the most handcrafted, tailored thing that you put a lot of attention into. It's like it, and setting up a board like you do here is like, it's like writing a whole novel in like comics, not even Comic Sans. It's like writing a whole novel in like a font that's hard to read, like Jokerman or something.
Right.
It's like if you can't like make sense of it from a glance, then it's going to be hard to understand the game or develop an understanding of the game.
Right. Or like if the flow of these different factions, like food is you start from the bottom, then go down, or you start from the top right, go down left in terms of resources to tunnel. Water mm-hmm. is from the bottom, go up right. Electricity is from the right, then kind of go up and around the markets and go back down from the left. And mm-hmm. then clouds are you start on the right and then you go backwards to the left, like reverse order through how early you're able to do their markets.
Right. So so in general, I think it's safe to say like left to right or right to left, pick a direction.
Top to bottom, bottom to top, pick a direction.
Top to bottom, bottom to top, or outside
clockwise,
in.
Counterclockwise.
Yeah. Or outside in. So, yeah. I mean, just pick a direction. Outside in, clockwise, counterclockwise. Left to right, right to left, top to bottom, bottom to top, whatever. Just as long as everything follows the same convention, so you just understand it way better, you can figure it out way easier. Yeah.
And if you think about it, like in video games, making sure that the player's muscle memory maps to certain ideas is pretty common. Like in a fighting game, you know, quarter circle forward almost always is the projectile that goes forward. So you would think in a board game, like moving a meeple from one position to another in a certain direction would usually mean something.
Yeah.
Or at least letting the player's eye motion follow to that point. There's one more thing I was going to say about the graphic design. Now I can't remember. You can see that they learned these lessons with like Scythe, you know.
Yeah.
If you go back in our Scythe episode, we talk about how well the factory board that you have flows from top to bottom mm-hmm. and like information's where you expect it to be.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say about the recruit abilities.
Mm-hmm.
That's that they seem like bait, like every ability that isn't one that just gives you a free resource for a thing. And any ability that requires that you spend something is just bad, especially the ones that make you spend a worker. It's like if you're not using this engine that we talked about, then you are probably wasting turns, and that's kind of what most recruit abilities kind of ask you to do.
Yeah, especially the ones that make you kill workers off.
Some of them will say like you can spend extra cards to place an extra star, and those seem good. But you still have to like go through a lot of trouble of managing a very high morale to keep all these different cards in your hand. I don't know. They just seem like if they're not doing the best thing in the game, then they're not doing anything at all.
This is like a concept I think I first saw in Agricola, and I saw a lot of designers sort of reference Agricola with that. Which is like not necessarily having a starting faction, but having starting like options available to you. In Agricola, mm-hmm. it's like the jobs or whatever, the occupations.
Right.
And the idea is these are supposed to guide your engine, but you have to make sure they're worth putting your engine into.
Right.
Or else they just don't work and they can even be negative to the experience.
I suppose it's a difficult balance where like on one hand you're juggling this spectrum that's like on one end it has zero bearing to your engine and it does nothing like in this game, versus on the other hand, it has so much bearing on your engine that it determines your entire strategy for you at the beginning of the game.
Yeah.
So you're given no control over what you want to do in this game. And if you choose to do the opposite, then you are going to lose.
Yeah.
So that's one thing you're trying to balance, I guess. And then the other thing is just like how good it is.
Yeah.
Or how big it is, like how big of an impact does it have, which kind of affects like your engine, but it also just affects like the ability itself.
Oh, yeah.
That it's giving you. Is that ability just good or bad in general? And so, yeah, I guess you in this game, they erred on the side of being cautious and saying like either it's going to be such a huge cost to take this ability that it won't come up so often. You know, yeah. That's how they balanced it on the power level. And then as far as engine goes, it rarely ever affects the engine.
You know, here's an interesting idea. Take the four main Stonemaier games so far, which are Viticulture, Euphoria, Scythe, and Charterstone, play them and study them in order. It's a pretty interesting like curriculum you can gather from them.
Uh-huh.
Just looking at the lessons learned and the advancements made from one to the next.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
That can make for an interesting end of the month episode, too.
Oh, yeah. Starting our Board Game Bros Board Game Study Club.
So yeah, it's like a book club, but it's a board game club.
Yeah.
Anyways. So the last point I want to make is that at least in this game, like every Stonemaier game, everyone finishes the game at about the same time.
Yeah.
Like when things are winding down and coming to an end, everybody is just a few turns away from ending the game themselves.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's just like a theme in Stonemaier games in general, but that's a good theme. It just means that it, regardless of what strategy you went with during the game and what decisions you made, you're it generally close to finishing the game at the same time as other players.
Yeah, and it makes for exciting experiences, you know,
mm-hmm.
to feel like, oh, I was so close. Being so close is better than, you know, losing by a long shot, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. When you lose, it's better to have been very close. At least personally. I guess there's maybe somebody who might say, like, I was so close. Now I'm so mad because, oh, if only I'd done that one thing, I would have actually won. Somebody puts a lot of importance on winning, versus, like, losing by a long shot. They'd be like, well, there was just no chance. What can I say?
Though generally, I found for me at least, and for a lot of my friends, that being close is more likely to make somebody want to play it again.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's like game design 101. Make your game, make them want to play it.
Come back for more.
Yeah.
Make them want more. Leave them wanting more. There we go. That's the pithy way of saying it.
Yeah.
Cool. That's about all I have to say about this game. Do you have any other points, Matthew?
No, pretty much just that. To sum it up, it's a game that is decent, but like is interesting for the sake of the lessons learned from it and through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. And that will conclude our episode on Euphoria.
It has a picture of the St. Louis Arch on the back of the market tiles.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Stonemaier Games is a St. Louis-based company, and we are a St. Louis-based podcast. So
technically.
Very cool. Pretty fun. We talked about the issues we have. And that's our episode on Euphoria. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
End of the episode plugs.
First of all, if you like Euphoria and you want to check out more games like it, you know, mentioned Scythe and Charterstone both have aspects as well as lessons they've learned from Euphoria.
Mm-hmm. And warning, Charterstone is a legacy game, so you'll play like 12 sessions of that before you reach the end state. But it carries a lot of the same mechanics from Euphoria regarding the workers and bumping workers and stuff like that.
Yeah. I would recommend Terraforming Mars as just an engine building game.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, just a really fun engine building game with a similar futuristic theme almost, in pretty similar resource management in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's tons of worker placement games out there.
You know, I recommend Champions of Midgard as a worker placement game with dice, but the workers aren't dice in that game.
Oh,
instead, your resources are sometimes dice, and those resources are warriors, which you must send on quests to fight monsters.
Yeah. Or if you want a similar like atmosphere or like a similar dreary worker placement game, Dead of Winter is pretty cool.
All right.
All right.
So, if you like our episode, you can leave us a comment or like us or follow us on any podcasting platform. You can follow us and chat with us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast. You can
Oh.
find all our episodes archived on our website, bgbcast.com, where we have them tagged. And you can, if you were interested in our thoughts on another game, you can find the tag for that game. That'll direct you to the episodes where we talked about it.
Also, we are on BoardGameGeek now, so if you have a BoardGameGeek account, you can follow us, become a fan on that,
Cool.
and comment on the forum through there.
We have a TeePublic store, teepublic.com/users/BGBcast. You can find a link for it on our website. That's where we sell our merch. You can go there and get merch and rep our cool, cool podcast with a cool, cool t-shirt. And we will close it out with Matt plugs.
Oh yeah. So first of all, I have been writing articles slash blog posts on the Board Game Bros website under the articles and episodes sort of column or whatever page. I have an article up that I uploaded a week or two ago about the modern Hitman games, and I am working on another one. Which topic it's going to be on is a bit to be determined. There's a few things I'm writing, and I'll see when that gets up. I'll obviously tweet about it. Also, I stream on twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I stream on weekdays from around 10 to or 11 a.m. Central Time to 2 or so p.m. Central Time. I play a lot of video games that are either difficult or competitive or, I don't know, interesting. So yeah, if you stop by stream, you can chat about, game design, board games, video games, what have you.
All right.
All
Very
right.
cool. That's the end of our plug section, and that's the end of our episode. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.